We're talking about so-called forever chemicals that allegedly leached from a northeastern Wisconsin fire training facility. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for being here. The DNR says that Johnson Controls International knew about the release of hazardous materials at its site in Marinette, which led to some well contamination. Do you live in that area? What do you want to know about this case and wells in your area? We're at 800-642-1234. Lee Berquist is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel who writes about local news and environmental issues. Lee, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
So we learned last week that the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources referred a case involving Johnson Controls to the State Justice Department for civil prosecution. So what is it that the DNR is alleging?
Well, they're alleging that these chemicals, as you described them, these forever chemicals, they're a hazardous chemical under state law, and that that Johnson Controls knew that these chemicals had been spilled into the groundwater on their site, and that they should have reported that to the DNR when they knew about it.
And it wasn't until 2017 that Tyco said it believed that chemicals had spread outside this property, this facility, Fire Technology Center. Did something fall through the cracks when Tyco and Johnson Controls merged?
That's a good question, and I'm not sure I can answer that. I do think when there was this combination of these two companies, that perhaps there was a breakdown in communication of some sort. I'm just not sure on that, but that certainly, I think, could be a factor here.
So where specifically have these chemicals been found and as a result of the contamination, and what are we talking about in terms of these chemicals?
Well, these chemicals have really spread several miles through the groundwater and in the surface water from the Tyco Johnson Controls facility on the edge of Marinette, and have been found actually in Green Bay. They've also gone, there are several ditches in the community. Really, they're essentially streams, and they flow towards the bay as well. They've been found there as well. And then they've been found in groundwater, both on the property and in areas of the town of Peshtigo and in Marinette, where people have private wells.
And I understand with these private wells, they started distributing bottled water to residents. What do we know about that timeline?
Well, that's about the time that they discovered in late 2017, when the company discovered that these chemicals had left their property. Then they moved quite quickly. Then they began distributing bottled water to affected residents who had private wells, who had their own wells. And in this case, they have distributed to about 125 residents bottled water. And in addition, they've paid for the installation of treatment systems in people's homes so they can drink their own well water, but it's treated through a system that takes out these chemicals.
We're talking with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Lee Berquist, who covers environmental issues. We're looking at the situation with Johnson Controls not informing state officials that it knew that so-called forever chemicals had leached from its site in northeastern Wisconsin. How do you want to see the State Justice Department handle this case? Do you think the company should have let authorities know that its site was contaminated right away, even if the contamination was confined to its own property? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So, Lee, what is Johnson Controls saying about the allegations that it knew that these chemicals were found in this fire training facility in Marinette?
Well, Johnson Controls says that it did not know about this until, or pardon me, that, you know, they in in 2013 when they first discovered these chemicals were in their groundwater, when they were actually looking for some other contaminants on their property. They said that that's when they believe that the chemicals at that time were on their property. They did not believe that they had gone any further than that, and so that there was no reason for them to inform the regulator, the Department of Natural Resources, and they've said that consistently for more than a year now, and that's their position, and that's, I think, the reason why it's being referred to the Justice Department. A lot of times in these cases, there's an acknowledgement by the party that there's a problem, and then they work out an arrangement with an agreement with the DNR. In this case, they just don't believe they've done anything wrong.
What is it about these perfluorinated chemicals that make them such a health hazard?
Well, I'm not a scientist. I know that there's properties in these chemicals that that can do a lot of different things. And in this case, I'm not sure if the right word is slippery, but it allows fire retardants that this company uses to move these fire retardants more smoothly and across an area where there's going to be a fire. In other cases, these chemicals are used for other products, and they just have these properties that have been used in many, many products over the years that help make these products better.
So when these chemicals get into a well, get into the water in Green Bay, how hard is it to get them out?
Well, it's going to be quite difficult. In the case in Green Bay, I'm not sure you can remove them other than the fact that over time, it's a big body of water. And so it's just these chemicals are in a big body of water. At this point where the water has been tested, the levels are at trace amounts. So at least at this point, nobody believes that there's a danger in the water that is in the bay. Now we'll see what happens over time. In the case of these ditches, Johnson Controls, at least in one case, and I'm not sure if it's in others, but Johnson Controls is treating that water right now with a treatment system where they actually have equipment in that ditch and they're trying to strip these chemicals out of the water.
Has the Justice Department said anything about how it may handle this case?
No. It, as they oftentimes do, they really just don't. Once they're in the middle of a case or at the start of a case like this, they just don't comment.
So you cover environmental issues, Lee. What are you watching for here as this case moves forward, as it unfolds?
Well, the continuing cleanup in Marinette, and how Johnson Controls and the community deal with that. The company has already offered to hook up the residents to City of Marinette water, and that'll be interesting to see how that goes. And then there's also some land that's outside of Marinette where some of these solids that come from the wastewater treatment system from Marinette, where over the years that after the wastewater is treated, there's these solids that remain, and somehow, and so then that stuff gets spread on land, on farmland.
And lots to look for there. Lee Berquist is a Milwaukee Journal reporter who writes about environmental issues. Thanks for your time. Coming up, we look at how eating disorders affect people working in food service industry. Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. We're talking about eating disorders and the food industry. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Constant exposure to food is what it's all about in the food service industry. Even if food is your passion, and it's what led you to the hospitality industry in the first place, there are risks in developing disorders with food in this environment. Think about a chef who struggles with an eating disorder. His restaurant kitchen is an especially painful place to be. Did you or do you struggle with an eating disorder during your time in the service industry? What challenges does working in hospitality pose for you? And how about those hours, those long hours? How do they affect you? What about access to food? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Hannah Howard spent 15 years working in restaurants in New York. She overcame anorexia and wrote a memoir called Feast, True Love in and Out of the Kitchen. Hannah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
And we have Claire Misko as well. She is CEO of the National Eating Disorders Association. Claire, welcome to you.
Thanks very much.
Well, Claire, let's start with you. How does the way that we interact with food become an eating disorder?
Well, eating disorders are very complex illnesses. We call them biopsychosocial. So there's a lot of compelling research to show that people may be genetically, biologically predisposed to developing eating disorders. We also know that there's a lot of co-occurring issues, including anxiety, depression. Many people with eating disorders have past issues of trauma and abuse. And there's also high rates of co-occurring substance use and alcohol use. So these are, you know, issues that are much deeper than just the food. And then, of course, we live in a culture where there's a glorification of thinness and perfection and a focus on achievement and, you know, a lot of pressure. So all of these factors combined have contributed to epidemic numbers of eating disorders. So, you know, again, these aren't issues that are just about the food. They're much deeper than that.
Help us understand, Claire, how eating disorders are categorized or what types there are.
Well, there is a broad range of illnesses that are in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, which is the manual that clinicians use to make diagnoses. With eating disorders, there's a range of illnesses. So you have anorexia, which is characterized by self-starvation. It's a very restrictive eating disorder. There is bulimia, which is binging and purging, and binge eating disorder, which actually is more common than anorexia and bulimia combined. And that's where someone eats, you know, with a sense of a loss of control. And then that's followed with, you know, extreme feelings of guilt and shame. And then there are many other disorders on the spectrum when we talk about eating disorders. And, you know, it's important to note, we hear from a lot of people at the National Eating Disorders Association whose issues and struggles around food and body image might not fit neatly into one of those diagnostic categories, but their thoughts and behaviors are causing, you know, an extreme amount of pain and disruption in their lives. So, you know, again, it's really important to think about the behaviors and how they're impacting your life.
Hannah, you overcame anorexia while working at restaurants in New York. How soon after you entered the food industry did you recognize that you had a problem? You had an eating disorder.
Well, I think that my attraction to the restaurant industry was a combination of a really positive thing, a genuine love and appreciation of food and the joy and togetherness that food can foster, the community, the beauty, all of these good things. But it also came from a place, like Claire mentioned, I did have anorexia, but I also have struggled with binge eating and restricting and, you know, all those permeations of eating disorders. And I think the other thing that drew me to working at a restaurant was this idea of controlling something that I had always, in some sense, been struggling with throughout my life.
So you really felt like if you could perhaps conquer being around the food service industry, that maybe you could get past what you were coping with in your eating disorder.
it did seem sort of like the ultimate challenge in that way. But at the time when I started work and my first restaurant job, I was had just turned 18. I was a hostess at a very fancy sort of old school French restaurant on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And there was this weird double-edged sword where I believed, you know, and I don't know how much of this was my diseased thinking and how much of this very well might have been reality, but I believed that I had been hired because I was thin. And it was true that the restaurant exists, you know, within our broader culture, which celebrates, you know, in a really extreme way, thinness as this ideal. And on the other hand, I was surrounded by this really extravagant, lavish, amazing, and abundant food all the time. So it was a strange situation to put myself in. And it, in a way, it really fostered, I think, my disordered eating. But in a way, it also helped me eventually, when I was ready, to recover.
We're talking about eating disorders in the service industry with Claire Misko of the National Eating Disorders Association. Hannah Howard here as well. She wrote the book Feast, True Love in and Out of the Kitchen. There's a line for you on this at 800-642-1234. Have you struggled with an eating disorder during your time in the restaurant business? What challenges does working in hospitality pose for you? Give us a call. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Claire, eating disorders can come up in different ways. Signs can be both physical and emotional. How difficult is it to recognize someone with an eating disorder?
Well, that's a really important question because it's not always visible. In fact, it often is not outwardly visible in terms of someone's body size, and that's one of the biggest myths that we face in the eating disorders field. Because unfortunately, when most people hear the term eating disorder, it conjures up an image of a very thin, white, young, affluent woman. And you know, while there certainly are young white thin women who struggle with eating disorders, that's not reflective of the majority of people who struggle. So you can't tell by looking at someone that they are struggling. So you really need to pay attention to the behaviors. You know, if you notice that, you know, someone is withdrawing from social situations, certainly if there's an obsession around food and eating, also obsession with exercise can be another warning sign that someone is struggling. We often see people who, you know, use extreme over-exercise as a form of purging or compensating for calorie consumption. So it's important to not focus on weight or physical appearance when it comes to eating disorders because these aren't always visible.
Hannah, I'm wondering, did people working around you in the restaurant notice any changes and confront you about your eating disorder?
I had this experience that now that I've talked about it, I realize is really common amongst people with eating disorders, which is that as I was losing weight pretty rapidly, I got tons of praise and compliments and people inquiring how I did it so they could do it too. And then, you know, at a certain point, it shifted a little bit to concern. And it sort of, you know, it seemed weird, like how come you were praising me just a few weeks or days ago, and now all of a sudden I'm doing something wrong. And I think that's one of the ways our culture really needs to do some work about what we value and what, you know, this connotation that thin is good or thin is healthy is really harmful. And then, of course, later, as my weight sort of boomeranged, I was just so embarrassed and people sort of stopped saying things. But I noticed in those behaviors that Claire mentioned that I wasn't alone. And I noticed people, you know, refusing to eat our staff meal, or I had a manager that I worked with and she had her one yogurt that she would make last through this 12-hour shift by taking these spoonfuls. And even though at the time I didn't really have the language to identify what was going on, I did know on some level that I wasn't alone with this stuff.
And so you were a host in a restaurant at an early age in your teens. Did you also, were you also a server? What were your other roles?
Absolutely. I really loved working in restaurants. After I was a host, I worked at a restaurant that had an amazing cheese cart, and I became fascinated with cheese. And I went on to work at a cheese center that had a cheese cave, and I worked at a cheese and wine bar as a server. I was a cook for a brief amount of time. And then after I graduated from college, I went on to manage restaurants first in LA and then in Philadelphia.
Talking with Hannah Howard, author of Feast, True Love in and Out of the Kitchen. Claire Misko with us as well, and she's CEO of the National Eating Disorders Association. Your experience is welcome. 800-642-1234. We'll continue this conversation about eating disorders after this news update right here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about eating disorders in the hospitality industry. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. National surveys show an estimated 20 million women and 10 million men in the U.S. will have an eating disorder at some point in their lives. And if you work in the food industry, you'll be continually exposed to the very thing that causes you difficulty. Few studies have been done in this area, but we do know that this profession can be very difficult. Managers, what do you watch out for when it comes to issues like eating disorders among your staff? What is your role in this? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Claire Misko is the head of the National Eating Disorders Association, and Hannah Howard is here. She's author of Feast, True Love in and Out of the Kitchen, and they stay with us. Let's go to the phones now with Chris joining us from Adams. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. I worked in restaurants mostly as a server for 30 years, and I don't know. The public has a very strange idea about what you get to eat and not eat in a restaurant. I have almost never worked in a place where it was okay for you to actually, like, have a meal. Most people who wait tables in restaurants don't even get the prescribed breaks that the federal government requires, much less get to sit down and eat something or bring something from home and eat something. What you do is you grab a roll or a piece of bread and cram it in your face. It turns out that I have celiac disease, and so that was, like, the worst thing I could possibly have been doing. And so what happens at the end of the night, and you drink a lot of caffeine to keep yourself moving. At the end of the night, your blood sugar is on the floor. You're all caffeinated up. You can't sleep. So you go home or you go to a restaurant and you grab something you probably wouldn't have eaten otherwise. It's a very toxic environment in terms of food. And it's not just that you're dealing with food. That's not the only toxicity. Toxicity is that you're not able to eat a real meal.
Chris, thanks for the call. Hannah, what do you hear there in terms of the situation that Chris found in restaurants she worked in?
I absolutely relate. I mean, I think even coming to work, sometimes we'd have an opportunity to have family meal, which was always my favorite thing when the employees could sit down before the shift and grab something to eat. But oftentimes that was not the case. And I think that the lack of food is one part of these really difficult, long shifts with so much adrenaline. You're running around all night. It's physically hard. It's emotionally hard. And then not to mention the sort of antisocial hours. One of the things that really challenged me was I felt like I was always working when everyone else was playing and vice versa. And then you get off of work and it's late and you're starving and you're exhausted. And it's a really hard way to have a balanced, healthy life. It just does not set up for that.
Yeah, Claire, it sounds like the situation that we're hearing, it's not very balanced and fair to a person's metabolism and just how the body works. How common is it for someone to have an eating disorder in the food industry?
Well, I think it's a lot more common than we hear about, and that's why I'm so glad that we're having this discussion today, because you know, we need more research to really understand the numbers here. But I can say anecdotally that I've talked to many, many people in the food industry who have struggled with eating disorders, and their illness and their struggle has really been amplified, exacerbated by exactly the conditions that your caller described and that Hannah elaborated on. You know, certainly for people who are already predisposed, you know, I talked earlier about how there is a lot of research to show that there are people who are biologically predisposed to developing eating disorders. That level of restriction and that kind of a high pressure environment can really be a trigger for eating disorders. So, you know, this is something that we need to explore further. And I think the more people who have this experience who come forward, you know, the more we can have this conversation and connect people to help. Eating disorders are, you know, people who struggle with eating disorders are often experiencing a lot of shame. You know, there's still, unfortunately, a lot of stigma and secrecy around eating disorders. So, you know, the more we talk about this and the more we create spaces for people to tell their personal stories, the better positioned we are to connect people to treatment and get them on the path to recovery.
And Hannah, you saw your coworkers who had eating disorders. What did you notice about their behaviors? And did you feel they related to you at all?
Absolutely. I mean, I echo Claire's, what Claire said, that shame is such a painful and common part of suffering from an eating disorder. And that was so much my experience, that even though I saw these behaviors going on around me, I mean, at the time when I was in the thick of it, I was so embarrassed and ashamed that I could barely admit what was going on to myself, much less anyone else. And when I finally was ready to ask for help, I think that first awareness, I met lots of amazing women and men in recovery, and I did meet chefs and food stylists and servers, and just that feeling and that knowledge that I was very much not alone was a huge part in starting to heal. And that's, you know, I was really nervous to write this book and to start talking about it. I thought that, what would people think? And instead, the reaction has been people that I never knew or expected, they all relate. And I think it's so common, and talking about it is such an important start.
We're talking about the challenges that workers in the food industry face, especially in regard to eating disorders. Talking with Hannah Howard, author of Feast, True Love in and Out of the Kitchen. Claire Misko is CEO of the National Eating Disorders Association. She's here as well. You've aligned to this conversation at 800-642-1234. If you had or you have an eating disorder, how did working around food often affect you? How did you cope? Share your story and your insights, 800-642-1234. Claire, what are some of the physical symptoms that you see with people with eating disorders? What happens to teeth, for instance?
Yeah, well, there are a lot of very serious medical complications associated with eating disorders, and it's important to note that eating disorders have the second highest mortality rate of any psychiatric diagnosis, second only to deaths associated with the opioid epidemic. So these are life-threatening illnesses. And you asked about teeth, and this is one that is a lesser known physical symptom or sign, but we actually work with quite a number of dentists who specialize in treating patients who have struggled with eating disorders. The process of purging the stomach acid can erode the teeth. So people who have struggled with bulimia or have purged for extended periods of time, often experience very, very serious dental issues. As was noted by your caller earlier, periods of starvation, fasting, can lead to a lot of physical problems, around metabolism. We have a lot of people who have heart problems after long struggles with eating disorders. We also see a lot of gastro issues. Again, these are very serious illnesses, but they are treatable. And the sooner you can reach out for help and get into treatment, the better the outcomes. We believe recovery is possible at any point, but certainly early intervention makes a big difference, when it comes to treating both the medical complications associated, and also dealing with the underlying psychological issues that are driving the eating disorder.
Claire, help us understand the emotional toll, and can you connect it with depression and anxiety?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, most people who struggle with eating disorders, there's some other, or multiple co-occurring psychological issues, including depression and anxiety. This is very, very common. It's a reason why when we talk about treatment, we need to treat all aspects of the eating disorder. So, as we noted, there are serious medical complications. You need to have a medical doctor. You also need to see someone who specializes in eating disorders, who can provide counseling, a therapist or psychologist. Many people with eating disorders also benefit from group therapy. And then there's the nutritional counseling, because as part of recovery, you need to learn how to integrate food and eating into your life in a more healthy and balanced way. So when we talk about treatment for eating disorders, we're really talking about a treatment team. But the emotional piece of this is huge. As Hannah noted, it's an all-consuming kind of disorder. You think about food, you obsess over food. There often are very serious and debilitating body image issues associated with eating disorders. Oftentimes people will really isolate themselves. It's a very lonely disorder. As we've noted a number of times, there's a lot of shame and secrecy. The eating disorder really takes over a person's life and makes it very, very difficult for them to engage with others and to feel good about themselves.
And Hannah, you wrote a memoir. You decided to share your story.
Absolutely. I'm a writer, and I've always loved to write personal things for whatever reason, but it took a long time to muster the courage to share what felt like such a deep, dark secret. And then I wrote a small essay just about my experience, and getting this feedback from people who had been there was incredibly encouraging and made me want to do more.
I'm going to pause right there, talking about eating disorders and the hospitality industry with author Hannah Howard and CEO of the National Eating Disorders Association, Claire Misko, with us. Your insights as well, 800-642-1234. As a worker in the food industry, do you find it difficult to take breaks or to eat, or do you find it difficult to eat after a shift due to working all day? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll be back to this conversation in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the challenges of working in the food service and hospitality industry when coping with an eating disorder. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're looking at all of these complexities around eating disorders in the food industry. You can join in with your questions, your insights, 800-642-1234. Claire Misko and Hannah Howard, stay with us. Claire is CEO of the National Eating Disorders Association, and Hannah wrote a memoir called Feast, True Love in and Out of the Kitchen. Let's go to the phones now with Melissa joining us from Madison. Hi, Melissa. What are your thoughts on this?
Hi. Yeah, I, as someone who recovered from anorexia 20 years ago, my perspective on this is that most women actually have some form of disordered eating if you consider that the diet industry, which is a total scam, is an extension of disordered eating.
Thank you, Melissa. Claire, what do you make of that, the diet industry is really big in this conversation of eating disorders?
Yeah, absolutely. And we know that dieting is a major risk factor for disordered eating and full-blown eating disorders. And, you know, there is absolutely a cultural piece of this because we are constantly bombarded in this culture with messages around weight loss and, you know, the quote-unquote perfect body. Now we have a lot of messages around health and wellness and, you know, a lot of mixed messages and a lot of products being marketed here and there. So it's a lot to navigate. And, you know, particularly if you have vulnerabilities, you know, like anxiety, depression, you're struggling with body image issues, it's very, very difficult to navigate this culture because a lot of the mindsets and the thoughts around disordered eating are actually validated in the larger culture. And, you know, Hannah spoke about her experience earlier, which I think I just want to echo that. We hear all the time from people who contact our helpline who describe their early experience in their eating disorder when they first started losing weight. And again, not all eating disorders manifest in weight loss, but that there is this positive compliments and positive validation of disordered eating. And that's happening in our broader culture too. So I think that, you know, pointing out the risks and dangers of diet culture is a critical piece of this conversation.
Hannah, Melissa said that she had recovered from her eating disorder 20 years ago. And it got me thinking, how and when do you say you've recovered? Like, how long is that timeline? And when can you say you've recovered?
That's such a personal decision. And I know amongst even people that I'm close with who have recovered, some people say, you know, some people are very proud to say that they have recovered, and other people prefer to say that they're in recovery and believe that it's a lifetime process. I kind of think somewhere in between is true. I do believe that I recovered, but I also believe that, you know, my recovery is contingent on continuing to take care of myself in these many ways that Claire touched on, physically, emotionally, you know, with a sense of community, even spiritually. And so I don't take it for granted. I know that an eating disorder, you know, relapse is really common and possible, but I feel very grateful to consider myself recovered for now.
Let's go to the phones again with Heidi joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Heidi.
Hi.
What would you like to say? What's your story?
So I'm actually in eating disorder recovery as well, and I actually want to do a short plug for the Milwaukee Needle Walk here. I am the coordinator for it. After 10 years of struggling with anorexia, I decided to bring it to Milwaukee and bring that message here. So Sunday, September 15th at Veterans Park, we're having it. But in terms of like the food industry, I worked in food service for a long time while I was sick, and just being around the food always reinforced it, because I worked fast food, of like being customers and being kind of stuck in that of like, I don't know that I want to live that life. But eventually, you know, building that relationship with food and just learning how to love myself a little bit more made it a lot better. And Nita was a big part of that. So I just wanted to say thank you to Claire as well.
Yeah, Claire, it sounds like there are support networks out there helping people like Heidi.
Yes, well, thank you, Heidi, for your leadership on the walk and for sharing your story and being part of our community. Yes, there is a community of people who are in recovery. And because of the shame and isolation that so many people experience, it's really important that you know that you're not alone. And there are many, many people out there who have these experiences, have supported people in recovery. We have many people in the NIDA community who are parents, who are partners, siblings. You know, that sense of community can make a huge difference in recovery. It's so important to know that you're not alone.
Heidi, I want to ask, you worked in food service for a long time. How did that go for you, coping with an eating disorder?
Yeah, it was definitely tough because being a restricting type of anorexia, it was, you know, you smell the food all the time. And so a lot of it for me was also a little bit reinforcing of like, I have this control and I don't have to eat this. So it reinforced it for a long time. And it wasn't until I really stepped outside of that world that I was really able to move forward from it.
Hannah, what do you hear from Heidi's story?
I relate to that as well. I think just I agree that eating disorders are about so much more than food, but food is how they manifest. And, you know, whatever kinds of obsessions are going on in our head, just being surrounded by food all the time in all the ways can really be tough. But for me, ultimately, you know, I still work. I don't work in a restaurant anymore, but I write about food and I'm a copywriter for some food companies. And getting to know these amazing people who, you know, get up at the crack of dawn every day and milk cows and make cheese and, you know, just sort of finding this love and appreciation for the amazing things that food can do has been an important part in my healing as well. And I feel lucky that I get to have this journey while working in the food world still.
And Hannah, we sometimes forget that people who may choose to dine in a restaurant may have an eating disorder themselves, your patrons. How can servers, restaurant workers be more inclusive to people who are in recovery from eating disorders?
I think that being kind and non-judgmental and generally generous, you know, can extend to people with eating disorders or any other, you know, people. The other thing that people would say with my book is even though they didn't struggle with an eating disorder, everyone struggles with something. So I think just extending that hospitality for which the industry is named whenever possible, you never know how you can help someone. And I think that's one of the true joys of working in the restaurant industry is watching someone have a really positive, happy experience and leaving with a night that they're going to remember. Like that feels really good. And so whatever you can do to make that happen for yourself and others, that would be my advice.
Claire, as we wrap up here, how can we change what's going on? How can we break the silence of eating disorders?
Well, I think the first part, and most importantly, is to start talking about experiences and talking about how widespread these illnesses are, really break that silence and shatter that stigma, because we know that everybody knows someone who has been affected by eating disorders. So we've got to start having those conversations. And I think the other piece of this is a message of hope. We've heard from a number of people who have struggled with these illnesses and, you know, have found recovery and paths to recovery. And so that's the other piece of this here. These are serious illnesses, but they are treatable. And, you know, with more conversation and more access to resources, more people can get well and go on to lead healthy and happy lives.
Claire, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me and for hosting this discussion. It's really important.
Claire Misko is CEO of the National Eating Disorders Association. And Hannah, thank you for being here. Hannah Howard.
Hi, I'm here.
Okay, thank you, Hannah. Hannah Howard spent 15 years working in restaurants and she overcame anorexia, wrote a memoir called Feast, True Love in and Out of the Kitchen. Just ahead, it's summer and kids, almost done with school. It means time for digital devices. We'll take a look at how to balance that technology. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.